In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses row and row that mark our place. And in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and reloved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. My name is Allison B. Young, and this is Gathered, Storied Botanicals. Welcome back. The words I just read belong to John McCrae. Those are his poppies blowing through the stanzas of his poem In Flanders Field. The Canadian doctor and lieutenant colonel stood on the battlefield in Flanders after losing a close friend who had been killed in the war. The terrain stretched out before him. It looked sandy and rocky, dotted with small shrubs. The landscape looked like the soft, undulating dunes of a beach, but he never saw the ocean. Instead, he saw blots of brilliant red poppies. I imagine their vibrancy struck him painfully. Their color, their wobbling in the wind, spurred him to write the poem. The poppy and the poem have gone on to become symbols of remembrance for the fallen of World War I. Flowers often help us remember. They uphold the memory of those we've lost, offer some brightness and comfort even in their absence. They have the ability, the power, to help us make peace with loss. Thinking about those blood-red poppies bobbing in the wind, I found myself thinking about how tightly bound flowers are to memory. So could flowers also help us remember lessons? Could they remind us of our errors or cruelty, even when their harshness fades over time? The Oscars are tonight. I haven't written much about movies, and I'm far from any film critic, but there are two movies that I have been thinking about a lot since seeing them both. Both are contenders for awards. Both gave off these aftershocks and emotional resonance that kept rippling through me long after seeing them. And both use flowers in subtle but deeply compelling ways. The first is Oppenheimer. The film by Christopher Nolan is a harrowing story, beautifully told, about the man who created the atomic bomb. The movie's form mimics the tick, tick-ticking of an impending explosion. We know what happened, but it was hard to sit still through the building tension. In one scene, there is a meeting at a round dining table. Oppenheimer himself is there, along with Louis Strauss, the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, who held some resentment and mistrust for Oppenheimer. There are also other scientists, government and military officials. And in the middle of the table is a centerpiece. Its form is full and round, made of mums, lilies, and gladiolas shooting out like spires. What struck me right away was the size of the arrangement. It was so tall for the table. Most florists who have ever made anything for a table will tell you, you have to make it low enough for people to see across from them. In fact, there's a general rule of thumb for this. From the end of your elbow to the tips of your fingers is the tallest you should make a centerpiece. When I was just learning to arrange flowers, my former boss would even set her elbow on the table and extend her arm up as a way to measure the height of her design. So when I first saw the flowers in Oppenheimer, I was puzzled. The little bit that I've learned about Nolan's films, he seems to be a director who considers every detail, every nuance of a film. Why wouldn't he give the floral design in the movie the same attention? But as the scene unfolded, I noticed the tension building. There's the question of security and whether a spy could get access to the makeshift town Los Alamos, where Oppenheimer and his team of scientists are working to develop the bomb. Lines of dialogue ricochet from actor to actor, and this taut musicality forms a rhythm. And then one of the actors stands, leans across the table, and slides the centerpiece to the side, revealing a character sitting behind the flowers who may have insight into the question of a spy. It's a relatively quick-paced scene, and likely most people wouldn't consider the flowers all that important to it. It's hard to tell how intentional this whole scene was in using the flowers, but I found it to be this lovely flourish in the dialogue, this really beautiful gestural moment in the movie. Instead of flowers serving as purely decorative, these static objects in the scene, they became a way to break up the dialogue, to emphasize its twists and turns. Nolan's use of flowers is subtle, and yet he showcases how flowers can uphold memory, and even language, too. The second film is The Zone of Interest, written and directed by Jonathan Glazer. To say I liked the movie would be to say I enjoyed the night terrors I experienced as a child. The feeling of watching the movie was visceral, lighting my nerves on fire. I emerged from the dark theater as I did from my childhood dreams, feeling disturbed and strangely vulnerable. The sheer power of this movie comes from its story, a story of the Holocaust, of the Auschwitz camp, and one family's complicity in carrying out its atrocities. It also comes from its artistic form, how Glazer tells the story. It's a disquieting work of art, disquieting and a kind of sonic alarm that's made of flowers. As the viewer, you never see what's happening in Auschwitz. Instead, you see a family's seeming ordinariness right next door. You see domestic scenes in the house. You see the family's patriarch and a Nazi commander, Rudolf Herz, making small talk with business associates. And you see scenes of the garden. The film takes place in the summer when things are in peak bloom. Roses climb the wall that separates the garden from the concentration camp. Large, fluffy hydrangea heads try to soften its gray. Sunflower stalks tower over the passing family members. To not see the horrors that took place in the concentration camp, to not see the genocide plainly, was a point of criticism from some viewers. But it also is what makes the film so powerful. Instead of seeing the atrocities, we hear them. We still catch glimpses from over the garden wall. There's a watchtower, a chimney belching smoke and flames, the incinerating of Jewish people drifting into the air that the family breathes. We are looking at the flowers, but the horrors seep into us. There's no way they can't. It is in this artful, dissonant way that Glazer uses sound and flowers as tools to tell this story. The tools work together, are in conversation with each other, oscillating between concealing and revealing. This is where the story's tension builds, where the gravity of the Holocaust gnaws at us. A low, industrial hum runs through the background of the film, punctuated by not-so-distant gunshots and screams. It becomes a presence that is more felt than heard. It becomes a kind of cinematic infrasound. Infrasound refers to a low frequency that hovers just under our ability to hear, but can still be perceived. these slow, deep wavelengths rolling right through us. It is believed that infrasound is why animals flee before a tsunami hits the shore. The near imperceptible rumblings warn animals to seek higher ground. There are even studies that indicate infrasound can cause adverse health effects, ranging from a general unease or anxiety, to elevated blood pressure, to even disrupting the nervous system. The sound and music of the zone of interest may not measure at infrasound's Hertz levels, but its low, foreboding effect creates the queasy, uncanny feeling that you are not alone in this house, in this garden. Something is coming, or else it's already arrived. The Hirst family seem unfazed or immune by these sounds, almost. The youngest Hirst, a baby, seems to cry and fuss throughout the movie, a symbolic warning that the family largely ignores. The wife's mother comes to visit and is so horrified by her daughter's proximity and role in the extermination of Jewish people that she leaves without saying goodbye. And by the end of the film, Rudolph begins to show signs that he may be contaminated by his very efforts to kill off the Jewish people. Meanwhile, the flowers loom in most scenes. They become watchful eyes, a ghostly echo of the soundscape. Out in the garden, Hedvig, the wife and mother of the household, walks her baby around flower beds, leaning the child close to their perfumed faces and offering her to smell a low-lying rose. They're also in interior scenes. Cut stems of gladiolas sit in a vase by the front door at the end of a narrow hall where a camera is positioned. Both begin to feel like spies tucked into these corners. A potted peace lily watches Hedvig try on a fur coat that's been taken from a victim in Auschwitz. Like the cameras hidden around the set during filming, the blooms are surveilling the characters. The flowers may be watching, but they are meant to conceal, to smudge out the sharp contours of the violence. They hide what has become unsightly to the Hirst family. In one scene, Rudolph scolds someone on the phone that other SS members are damaging the lilac bushes that are meant to decorate the camp. In another scene, Hedvig shows off her garden to her mother. "Yes, that's the camp wall," Hedvig explains. "We planted more vines at the back to grow and cover it. And yet, the more we see these flowers, the more they reveal and illuminate the violence and cruelty." Hedvig and her mother sit in the garden. Their conversation fades, and the soundscape replaces their dialogue. The hum, the screams, and gunfire from the other side of the wall rise in volume, while we're faced with bees buzzing over petunias and sedum. Brightly colored dahlias get their close-ups. The camera looks up to a row of giant sunflowers. They are backlit, their heads heavy, and turned back down, returning their gaze to the camera and viewers. This shot felt especially striking because it feels like a nod to the German artist Anselm Kiefer, whose large-scale works grapple and confront the legacy of Nazism, the collective traumatic imprint left from the authoritarian regime. Seeing Glaser's shot reminded me of Kiefer's paintings of large black sunflowers, as well as his sculptures of tall dead flower stalks. A close-up of a red dahlia fades to a red screen. The screams cut abruptly to silence, where we're asked to sit with this glaring discomfort, the harsh juxtaposition of our humanity and our capacity for mass annihilation. While Oppenheimer crackles and fizzes like a lit fuse, the zone of interest rumbles and bellows under our feet. Both films are hauntings. There are many parallels to draw from these two movies, but the filmmaker's use of flowers was the most striking to me. Nolan's use is subtler. He breaks floral design rules for the arrangements to become useful gestures that the actors can interact with. The flowers become extensions of a character's dialogue. Glazer casts the growing flowers into the film, lets them play off of the other actors and set design. They feel as necessary to the zone of interest as the very cameras that filmed the movie. In this way, I'd say Jonathan Glazer made a film that is also a floral design. He arranged a bouquet that he does not lay at a gravesite out of remembrance, but at our feet, the living. Like Kiefer's work, we are being confronted. He has arranged the flowers to face us, to lean down over us and to ask us to reckon with the ghosts we have inherited from history, to hear the thrumming that is their warning. Gathered, Story Botanicals is a monthly podcast with room and the will to grow. It was written, recorded, and produced by me, Allison B. Young. You can subscribe to the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen. And if you liked what you heard, please consider rating the show on Apple Podcasts and leaving a review. Head over to gathered-storybotanicals.com to learn more. And wherever you are, wherever you come from, I hope you'll gather round. Thank you for listening, and until next time.